Okay, so I'd like to get started. So last time I talked about, well, I sort of finished, at least for now, with what I call quantum weirdness, which was there's in addition to the bizarre aspect of quantum mechanics where you can't really be deterministic about things, in that the particles are defined as a wave which has some extent, and all you can really pull out of it are probabilities, which is a strange aspect of quantum mechanics compared to Newtonian physics. In addition, because of the wave aspect, in fact, there is really inherent uncertainty that you just cannot beat in quantum mechanics, period. And that is quantified by something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle I talked about last time. And what it means is that there are pairs of variables, pairs of things that you could try to measure, that you cannot measure each of the two things to infinite precision simultaneously. So I can't know the position and momentum of a particle to infinite precision. And there's nothing like that in Newtonian physics. You can know it, you know, if I could build a good enough experiment, I could measure the position and momentum of a particle to an arbitrarily good precision. But that is inherently not true in quantum mechanics. And so what that means is you really can't know everything about a particle to begin with. And that really does remove any possibility of really having a deterministic universe, or putting all the information about particles in a computer and being able to calculate the future. And, you know, for the most part, it doesn't really matter to us. You don't really see it. In the big world, for example, this doesn't really make much sense, or you don't need to worry about it. But in the world of subatomic particles, this becomes very important. And I mentioned sort of the way I think about this. If you're trying to measure where a particle is in the big world, you want to bounce light off of it or something, and that would be, you know, basically using a radar gun or a laser rangefinder or something. You could figure out where the car is and how fast it's going, and in principle, you could do it with arbitrary precision. But if you try to do that game with a subatomic particle, I mean, you have to bounce something off it to observe where it is. The problem is, anything you can think to bounce off it basically blasts it, and you no longer know its momentum. So this kind of thing becomes really important when you consider the world of the very small. The reason that I bring this up, beside it just being strange, is it actually has within it the seed of what we use to really understand the nature of forces and how particles interact in quantum theory today. And the form of the uncertainty principle that we use to do that is the one where the uncertainty and the energy and the uncertainty and the time over something exists. The two of those can't be known to arbitrary precision. So that really opens up a new sort of world for us, in the sense that a particle moving through a vacuum can actually emit another particle, really apparently breaking conservation of energy, so long as that only happens over a very short time. Since that may sound sort of strange, but if you're trying to calculate what happens with this particle as it's going through a vacuum, you have to include all possibilities, because that's what quantum mechanics is about. It's about probabilities and possibilities. And so the fact that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle allows this particle to emit some other particle, and so long as it comes back over a short time and the uncertainty principle is satisfied, means you have to take that into account in your calculations. And if you exchange one of these particles, which we call virtual particles, because they don't really exist, because they can only be there for such a short time that you don't violate the uncertainty principle, we call them virtual particles. If one of those virtual particles gets exchanged, that turns out to be the mathematical model that we use for the paradigm theories of forces in particle physics today, which is extremely successful. So we're going to come back to that. So the idea is that you basically exchange these virtual particles. That's the way you model the force. And since these particles can carry characteristics like momentum or charge or whatever, it's like two people standing on ice throwing a ball back and forth. They actually can exert a force between one another, because if I throw the ball, it pushes me back. When the other person catches the ball, it pushes them back. So that would be sort of like a repulsive force in this picture. So it may sound sort of crazy, but it works really well. So we're going to come back to this. I wanted to leave it at the moment, because what I'd like to do is to begin to dig into the nature of inner space and basically talk about the structure of matter and the first stage in that, before we get to subatomic particles and forces, where we'll come back to this, is basically the structure of nuclei. So I wanted to do nuclear physics today. So you may be wondering, if you signed on for a multiverse course, why we're going to talk about nuclear physics. And the reason is that a lot of the multiple universe concepts that are out there are tied up inherently in cosmological theories, theories of the evolution of our universe, theories, basically the idea of the Big Bang and the expanding universe and all this. In order to really paint why we believe in the cosmology, the cosmological theories that we have today, you basically need to understand a bit about nuclear structure and how stars and things work, okay? And then hopefully we'll have the background that I can convince you that we're not crazy when we talk about the expanding universe and things like the Big Bang, that there's a lot of really compelling, strong evidence that supports these things. But that will launch us really into the bulk of the multiverse concepts that I wanted to talk about. So are you okay with that? The other reason that I would like to do nuclear physics today is because of the horrible stuff that's happening in Japan. So it turns out to be a horribly timely subject for us to hit. So so I guess I'll jump into it. We've talked about the atom, the idea of the atom, and we talked about the Bohr atom, where Bohr had this model of a nucleus, if you recall. And Bohr's idea of this nuclear atom, where all the positive charge is concentrated at the center, came from time that he spent with Ernest Rutherford and his lab in England in about 1912, 1910. And Rutherford was instrumental in developing this idea of the nuclear atom. And there were two primary models at that time, one where you put a lot of the positive charge at the center and you have negative charge around the outside. And actually the primary model of the day was the plum pudding model. I don't even know if this was really accepted all that, or thought of all that much as a competing model at the time. But what Rutherford would do is they would darken a room, and they had a source of a material which would emit alpha rays, and I'll talk to you later today about what those really are, but basically just think of them as sort of heavy charged particles. And this substance was naturally radioactive, and we'll talk a bit more about what that really means, but it basically means these nuclei are prone to fall apart and emit these particles, these alpha particles. So these alpha particles are coming off, and it turns out that if you have a zinc sulfide, a thin zinc sulfide screen in a dark room, and you put it near a source that's emitting alpha particles, when the alpha particles hit the screen, they'll cause a little bit of light to be emitted where they hit. It's called scintillation light. Basically, when the alpha particle goes through the zinc sulfide material, it will knock some of the electrons in the atoms off, and when they cascade back down, when they reattach to the atoms, they'll emit some light. It's called scintillation light. And so what what they did to explore the fundamental structure of the nucleus was they put a very thin gold foil between the zinc sulfide screen and the alpha particle. And they actually collimated this beam. That is, they just put a bunch of material right here and right here so that the beam would come and it's from a certain direction. Okay, and what they expected to see if the plum pudding model of diffuse positive charge with the negative charges sort of planted around as if they were raisins in plum pudding, if you were to predict what you would see in terms of the alpha particles going through the gold foil, what you would actually expect to see is that the alpha particles being positive would sort of go through this diffuse positive stuff, and they might get attracted a little bit by one of these negative electrons or something as they pass through. But more or less, you would have very small deviations in the direction of the alpha particle. So they could look for that by having this collimated beam of alphas coming a certain direction and then taking the zinc sulfide screen and asking how many times they see scintillation light here or here or here or back here. That way they could sort of get an angular distribution of these alphas after they went through or were reflected from the gold. In this model, you don't actually expect to ever see alpha particles kicked backwards. And what they found was that when they did the experiment, they found that there was a pretty high probability relative to what they would have expected with this model of having the alphas go backwards or, you know, at very large angles. And the only way they could understand that is if you concentrated all of the positive charge at a point so that when the alpha particle approached it, it basically saw this big positive charge, which would give it a big repulsive kick, which was a very different model for the atom than other people had thought. Yeah.
Why did only some of them, or only some of them repel them?
Because to get the big kick, you have to more or less get very close to the nucleus, and the nucleus is very small. So it's like you're throwing darts. The probability of you actually hitting the bullseye is very small. Right, you can throw 100 darts, and the probability of getting, you know, within a few inches is actually pretty high. But when you ask how often you get that close, it's not very often. And so this type of probability distribution was well understood by these guys, and so they actually inferred from the distribution of these alpha particles coming off, they were able to infer just how big the nucleus was. They could tell that the positive charge had to be concentrated in something that's, you know, roughly a certain size in order to actually reproduce the data.
So and the probability before they fired the alpha particles?
Well, I think they were surprised by it, but yeah, you can calculate the probability distribution with a model like this, or you could calculate it with a model with the positive charge concentrated in different size regions. Yeah, so this is what physicists get paid to do. So, I mean, they can do that kind of calculation. So, at any rate, this data was actually pretty solid. So there wasn't a lot of debate about that apparently nature has this nuclear model. And so the picture that we have now of the nucleus, or of the atom, is basically, there are two types of particles inside the nucleus, and I'm not giving you the history of how we know that because I'm wanting to make time for other things today. So the blue things we'll call protons, and those are particles that are substantially heavier than electrons, I mean a lot heavier. And they have positive charge. And then we have particles that are very similar to the protons, which are neutral. And those are called neutrons. And the nucleus itself is very tiny. It's about got a size, I mean, roughly on the order of 10 to the minus 15 meters in size. Whereas the atom itself, so if you look at the region where the electrons might be found, where you've seen pictures of these electron orbitals from when we were talking about Schrodinger's equation, the atom itself is sort of on the size about the size of 10^-9 meters. So the nucleus itself is a million times smaller than the actual atom, and of course the electron is as far as we know is point-like. We don't know of a size to it. It could be distributed in this region, but at some level the atom is mostly empty space, with most of the mass, because the neutrons and protons are so heavy relative to the electron, most of the mass is concentrated right at the center. So this is the basic picture that we have of the atom. And there's some big implications to this. Well, let me ask you, what's wrong with this picture? What bothers you? Yeah.
Well, just with this, I mean, I don't know if the electrons are implied, but there's no electrons, so they don't know.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. Let me. They're implied here. I just sort of. But let's be more specific. So, generally speaking, for the nuclear model, we have what usually we use the symbol Z. So there's Z protons. There are A minus Z neutrons. A protons plus neutrons and Z electrons. Okay, so what is all this A, Z, and whatever? Hydrogen has a Z of 1. So there's 1 proton in hydrogen and there's 1 electron. Helium has a Z of 2. There are 2 protons, 2 neutrons. So it has... if you think of the mass of the atom in units of a proton, it's 1. So helium would have 2 protons, 2 neutrons, and it would have a mass of 4 in the appropriate units. And then the atom is typically neutral, so there are as many electrons as there are protons. Okay, so that's the basic idea.
If all the positives are hanging out together, shouldn't they repel?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, at some level, this is a totally wacky picture, right? Because we've done Coulomb forces, and if I thought to, I'd have you do this in the recitation, but I forgot to do it. You can calculate the force between the positive charges, these protons, when they're 10^-15 meters apart. Remember, the Coulomb force goes as 1 over r squared, so if r gets really, really tiny, that number becomes huge. So the force between two protons when they are that close to one another is tremendous. There's no reason in the world that the nucleus should hold together if that's all there is to the picture. It's a completely crazy picture. So when Rutherford's people showed that in fact the atom apparently has this nucleus where all the positive charge is concentrated in such a little small space, it immediately tells you that there's another force in nature that we haven't talked about yet. And it has to be a force that's very strong, because it has to be stronger than the Coulomb force. It has to be able to hold these positive charges together in the face of this massive repulsion of the Coulomb force. So we call that force because physicists are so creative, we call that force the strong nuclear force. And Rutherford could even tell us more about this force than that. He could tell that, or we could tell from things like Rutherford scattering, that in this region, the only force that could be felt was the Coulomb force. The way in which these particles scattered, there was repulsion, and it was as if the Coulomb force was all that was at work. But we know that if this positive charge is stuck in this region of 10 to the minus 15 meters, there must be this really strongly attractive force that somehow has a range that is sort of confined to that 10 to the minus 15 meters or whatever. And so that turns out to be the strong nuclear force that we call it. Yeah.
Is there any way to simulate the strong force and, like, you know, have neutrons attracted to each other? Or protons attracted to each other?
Yeah. People do a lot of that. So we actually know a whole lot about the strong force, and I'll get there. But for now, let's just say there is a force that apparently is stronger than Coulomb force. It has a short range, and protons and neutrons feel it for whatever reason, and electrons don't. Okay, and that's basically the picture of the atom. Now, once you say that, then you get some interesting things. If you recall, when we talked about the Schrodinger equation solution to the hydrogen atom. Remember how we started that? We basically said, remember, Schrodinger's equation is this crazy wave equation that looks all nasty, okay? And basically what the physicists do is they take a physical situation and they describe it mathematically, basically, and put it into this equation. So how you solve for the atom is you put within this equation a system which consists of a positive particle with a negative particle attracted to it by the Coulomb force. And when you put that into the equation and you solve it, out pops the solutions for the atomic orbitals and things which we've talked about to describe atoms, which you can then also use to do chemistry and everything. It turns out that if you look at Schrodinger's equation and you put within it an attractive force of any sort, it will always give you discrete energy levels, just like we have in the atom. And so that's exactly what we have now. We have a new force, the strong nuclear force, and clearly it's attractive because it's holding these particles together in the nucleus. So if we were to assume these particles are waves like electrons, which quantum mechanics says they are, then it means that the nucleus should have different energy levels for the different nucleons, the protons and neutrons, when the nucleon is sort of the generic word we use for them, within it. So just like we have all of this orbital structure in the atom, you have a similar thing in the nucleus itself for the different nucleons. So just like with the atom, if you had a lot of electrons, you would populate the different levels, energy levels in the atom. We do the same thing in the nucleus. So you can imagine having a low energy state and a next higher energy state and a next higher energy state, and a next higher energy state within the nucleus. And then within the nucleus, you might have protons, which, like electrons, they have spin, so you can put two of them in each of these energy levels, sort of like we did with electrons. And they can populate different levels, and at the same time, in parallel, you can have the neutrons do the same sort of thing. So this is the kind of game that you play with nuclei in order to understand them. And so it actually uses a lot of the intuition that we've developed for atoms. It's the same sort of thing. So you could imagine, if this were true, then just like with atoms, if you recall, we have the discrete spectral lines coming from atoms, and those correspond, for example, light is emitted if an electron hops from one energy level down to one with lower energy, it will emit light of exactly that difference in energy. Okay, and since those shells are determined by the charge of the nucleus, every type of atom, every type of element, gives a different set of lines that it emits. So we saw the spectral lines earlier for atoms. So if this is true, you might imagine that you would have exactly the same sort of thing for nuclei. That, in fact, if a proton drops from one energy level to another, it should emit light of a very particular frequency, just like with the atom. And it does. But there's a huge difference. In atoms, when we calculated the difference between these energy levels, the type of energy difference that we saw was on the order of electron volts, or maybe tens of electron volts at best. Because the force for the strong interaction is so very strong to be strong enough to overcome Coulomb repulsion at that range, when you calculate the difference between the energy levels in a nucleus, the level of the differences is on the order of millions of electron volts. So it's like, a million times more energetic. Anything that happens is going to happen a million times more energetic if you rearrange things. So what this means is that the light that gets emitted when one nucleon drops from one level to another in a nucleus doesn't come out in the range of visible light or UV or ultraviolet or something like it does with normal atoms. It comes out as gamma rays, which are way, way more energetic. Okay? How are we doing? I'm going a little fast today, and I'm talking a lot. Any questions? Okay, so you have this, it's almost like an onion. We have this shell structure for atoms, and we have the electromagnetic force, and you get transitions that can cause the spectral lines. And then we have a different force governing the nucleus, and you can actually have transitions between different energy states in the nucleus. And so it's a very similar sort of thing. Okay, now there's a big difference though. At the energies of tens of electron volts, which is the kind of energies you deal with when you rearrange electrons in atoms. So things that are chemical or nature are where you're rearranging the electrons in the atoms. The kinds of energy changes we're talking about are tens of EV or electron volts. So they're very small, okay? An electron is a very light particle as far as big subatomic particles go. It has a mass of 500,000 electron volts. So on the scale of even a light particle like electrons, the kinds of energy changes in atoms is very, very small. So all that they can emit are bits of light, photons. Okay? With nuclei, you have changes on the order of millions of electron volts. So if you have changes on the order of millions of electron volts, all of a sudden you have the freedom to emit things other than photons, because energy is equal to mc squared, right? So if I have enough energy to create a particle with a certain amount of mass, then maybe I do that. So there are a number of other avenues that are available. So what I'd like to do is to talk a little bit about how we think about nuclei. And we symbolize them with something that looks like this. Okay. This piece is the atomic symbol. So that's H for hydrogen, HE for helium, in case you think this actually makes sense, it's AU for gold, SN for tin, etc. Okay. So those are the atomic elemental symbols. So if you go to the periodic chart or whatever, these are the symbols you'll actually see. There's a, for each one of these elements, what is really specific for it is this tells you how many protons are in the nucleus. So in the case of hydrogen, that's 1. In the case of helium, it's 2. In the case of lithium, it's 3. In the case of gold, I forgot, but, you know, 96 or something like that. Z is known as the atomic number, and that's the number of protons. So if you actually look at this, this is redundant information, okay? Because by writing the symbol, I actually am already defining how many protons I have in the nucleus. But still, people write it that way, just so you know. A is the sum of the numbers of protons and the numbers of neutrons. And you can basically, since those dominate the mass, this is often called the atomic mass. So the number of neutrons is going to be A minus Z in the nucleus. Okay? Now, I have to do this because I want to talk about what nuclei can do, and we're going to use this type of symbol. So you could imagine that within a nucleus, the numbers of protons and neutrons stay the same, but you have a transition of one of the protons or neutrons between one level or another. So I could imagine having an excited nucleus, and what I mean by that is it could have a proton or a neutron in a high energy state of some sort, which then cascades down to a lower energy state, and when it does that, it could emit a photon, a bit of light. So there could be a complete analogy to what we've done with atoms, except now the change in energy is very high, so the photon that's emitted has a lot of energy, and it's known as a gamma ray. So I'm going to symbolize this by creating a nucleus with a mass of A and Z protons, and I'm going to put a star here that means that it's excited. So there's some nucleon in a high energy state. If you have a nucleus where you have this sort of thing, it can decay into the ground state or something where you no longer have the nucleon in a high energy state, but it's now down a low energy state, and emit a photon, okay? And this photon will turn out to be very high energy, and it's a gamma ray. It's in the gamma part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and we give it a symbol of the gamma, okay? There are naturally occurring nuclei out there that are like this, that will just decay into a less excited version of themselves and a gamma ray. So cobalt-60 is a version of that, for example. And if you have a pile of that near you, it's dangerous because the gamma rays most of them will actually pass right through you, but once in a while, one of them will interact, and when they do, they'll basically turn into an electron and its antiparticle, which are charged, and those charged particles now have a lot of energy, and they can rip molecules apart in your body and cause ionization, which basically is radiation damage, which could eventually lead to cancer, for example, or it can, if you have enough of it, it can basically age your cells very quickly and kill you right away. So this is one form of if you talk about radiation and you're not thinking electromagnetic radiation, this is one form of it. Of course, in this particular case, this is doubly deceptive because this is electromagnetic radiation. It's just very high energy. Okay? Now, other things can happen, which is why I had to use the various symbols here. You can have a nucleus, I'll call it X prime, whatever that is, that has Z and A. It can decay into a different type of nucleus, so I have a different symbol instead of X prime, I use X, where it has the same atomic mass, so the same number of protons and neutrons, but one of the neutrons changes into a proton and an electron gets emitted to conserve charge. So this is now a totally different type of strange transition, right? It just so happens that in this case, if I were to calculate the total energy of all of the nucleons populating the different energy shells in this nucleus, it will take more energy for that than it would if I calculated the same thing for this nucleus, where one of the neutrons converts to a proton and you emit an electron. So because it's energetically favorable, this will actually happen. And some nuclei are unstable or semi-stable. They can more or less exist like this for a long time, but then eventually they'll just decay, and when they do, they'll emit this particle. So this particle that comes out, it's really just an electron, but people didn't know this early on, and so they were all about rays in the early days. So we call this a beta ray, or beta radiation. A beta is nothing but an electron or its antiparticle. So you can have a similar situation where you go to Z minus 1, where one of the protons decays into a neutron, and to conserve charge it emits a positive electron, which is known as a positron. Either of these would be called beta rays. So this is a form of naturally occurring radiation. There are substances where this kind of thing just happens. And it's not a theoretical thing. I mean, it's all around you right now. I mean, this kind of stuff is happening where you're sitting, in your body. So there's another type of natural radiation that happens where you have, we start with our starting nucleus, and in this case we emit an alpha particle, and an alpha particle is the same thing as two protons plus two neutrons. Okay, so these are sort of the three main types of radiation that you can have. And all of them you can think of as a reconfiguration of the protons and neutrons within a nucleus. But basically, in this case, you actually change the type of matter that you've got from, you know, a nucleus of one sort to a nucleus of a different sort in the beta and alpha, right? So you... Yeah. You all right? Any questions on this? All right. Now, in recitation this week, I actually am going to ask you to think about this kind of stuff a little bit. This kind of stuff hitting your body is not good for you necessarily. Okay, this is a highly charged particle. It has a charge of +2 because it takes two protons and two neutrons out of the nucleus. If it hits biological tissue, it can actually ionize it heavily and cause significant damage. Okay, so this is why you can have mutations if it hits your DNA. This is why the dentist puts not so much for alpha, but they usually use they use X-rays, which are sort of lower energy than gamma rays. But they put lead over your gonads, basically, because if the photons, the high energy photons, interact in your gonads, they'll ionize the DNA, which can cause birth defects and things. So you know that it's a serious business. These are heavily charged, so they don't penetrate material very far. But if they're inside your body, they're very damaging, so you don't want to drink an alpha source. Betas are sort of in between. Gamma rays are a lot like X-rays. They'll go through a lot of material, but if I had a big, strong beam of gamma rays going through material, some of them would interact along the way, and some of them would go all the way through. Those that interact, it's very penetrating, and where they interact, they can cause damage. So outside your body, something that emits gamma rays is very dangerous because the gamma rays can actually penetrate into your body and hit vital organs. So in the end, if you have a source that emits beta rays or alpha particles outside your body, basically the worst it's going to do is give you something that's akin to sunburn. It's going to damage your skin a little bit, but it can't get to your vital organs. If you've got a gamma source outside your body, it can, and that's very dangerous. The danger gets flipped if you ingest it, because now gamma rays, if you drink a gamma ray source, you're going to glow gamma rays, but most of them aren't going to interact in your body. But if you drink a source with beta or alpha, all of that energy is going to be in your vital organs. So it's very, very bad business. So these are the types of things that can naturally occur in nature, and that... So this is sort of collectively what people call radiation or natural radiation. So when they talk about the radiation in Japan right now, they're talking about different substances that can emit this kind of stuff. Okay? And a lot depends on where the stuff goes. There are a number of factors that come into play. One is what type of particle gets emitted. So I gave you a bit of a flavor for why that is important. Another is where it might show up in your body. One of the things you'll read a lot about right now is iodine in the Japanese crisis. People talk about taking iodine pills. And the reason that's important is there's a particular type of a radioactive substance which can be produced in these reactors, which is iodine. And the iodine, if you were to ingest it, basically gets concentrated in your thyroid. So if you have a lot of that stuff in the environment and you ingest it, you'll get a concentration of it in your thyroid, and it will damage the thyroid a lot, and that's a very bad thing. So one of the things people do is they take non-radioactive iodine and basically saturate the thyroid so the thyroid doesn't collect other iodine if you happen to ingest it. So it reduces severely the amount of the radioactive stuff you would take in if you're ingesting it. So if you read much about the crisis, there's a lot of, they'll talk about the fact that they're giving iodine to people in Japan and that people in California have made a run on iodine pills and stuff like that. There's a word that's going to slip out, which I guess I'll go ahead and let you know. An isotope is you can have two different nuclei which are the same chemically. They have the same number of protons. But different numbers of neutrons. So, for example, hydrogen typically you think of as just a proton. But there is a form of hydrogen which has a proton and a neutron, which is called an isotope to normal hydrogen. And this is happens to be called deuterium. Or you can have a proton and two neutrons, so it has a mass of three, but it still has the same single positive charge, and it have one electron. This is called tritium. Usually you don't get the different names. But what this means is that you can have substances that are chemically the same, but have nuclei that are different. And so that's why you can have a form of iodine which is radioactive, which means it's going to naturally decay and emit particles, or you can have forms of iodine that are completely stable. These are different isotopes. So basically they have the same number of protons but different numbers of neutrons. Okay, so some isotopes of a specific substance are radioactive, that is, they'll fall apart and emit particles, and others are stable and will never fall apart and are completely safe. Yeah?
How does the number of neutrons make something more stable?
It means the energy structure for the strong nuclear force in the nucleus is just different. And in some cases that's unstable, in other cases it's stable. Yeah. Let me not build on that, but yeah, I can say more, but probably shouldn't. Not all radioactive substances are equal. Some are more dangerous than others, and there's a way of quantifying that. Some of these nuclei are more unstable than others. So if I had a handful of stuff here, sometimes the nuclei are pretty stable and only once in a while something will decay. And if that's true, this stuff is actually pretty safe. I can have a handful here and I'm not going to be in danger because not many of these nuclei are going to decay. On the other hand, sometimes the material is very unstable. And if I have a handful of this stuff, a whole lot of the nuclei are decaying all at once, and it poses a massive danger to me as a person. Okay, so we quantify that with something known as a half-life. So the half-life is basically, you think of it as the time it takes for half the nuclei in a sample to decay. So something with a short half-life means the nuclei are very unstable and are likely to decay quickly. Something with a long half-life, the nuclei are more stable, and so it's a bit more safe. Okay? Turns out that all of these different radioactive substances have characteristic different half-lives, which people measure. So sometimes you can actually identify what it is that's going by what it's by the half-life, by basically counting effectively how many decays are happening and figuring out how long it takes for half of the substance to decay. How many of you have ever heard of radiocarbon dating or radioactive dating? All right. So the half-life sort of gives us a way of getting into that, of understanding that. I mean, there are lots of applications for this. right now you're going to hear a lot of bad things about radiation because we have this uncontrolled release happening in Japan and people are very worried about it. Fine, I mean, rightfully so. But radioactive substances also have a great number of really useful things that we can do. One of the fun things is actually we can use radioactivity to get a very precise date on materials that were once living. And the way that this happens is the following. There's an isotope of carbon. Normal carbon has 6 neutrons, so this would be its symbol. Carbon is the symbol for, C is the symbol for carbon. You have 6 protons and 6 neutrons. That isotope of carbon is totally stable. All right, you can put a pile of it here and nothing will ever decay out of that radioactively. There is a form of carbon which has 2 extra neutrons. So it's called carbon-14. And it is radioactive, which means it decays naturally. When it decays, it actually decays into, it will emit a beta particle, it will emit an electron. It has a half-life of 5,730 years. So if I have a gram of carbon-14 sitting here, if we came back in 5,730 years, there'd be a half gram of that carbon-14 sitting here. Right? That's basically what it means. Now, it turns out that on a geological time scale, 5,000 years is nothing, right? So if you think about when the Earth was formed a long time ago, any carbon-14 that was around at that time has long since decayed away. It's basically, you know, it's just gone. So what happens, it turns out that in the air that you breathe, there is a little bit of carbon-14 anyway. And the source of this carbon-14 comes from cosmic rays hitting the atmosphere. So we have the Earth, and around the Earth is the atmosphere. And it turns out that the Sun and other astrophysical objects emit naturally some nuclei, protons and stuff, that some of the hydrogen in the Sun can get spewed out of the Sun, basically. So these are basically particles that can impinge on the top of our atmosphere. We call such things cosmic rays because it sounds funky, but it's really just nothing but normal particles. So we have cosmic rays hitting the top of the atmosphere. These cosmic rays, these protons that have some energy, can actually hit particles at the top of the atmosphere and cause nuclear reactions, basically rearranging the nuclei. When they do this, they will actually form a little bit of carbon-14. Not a whole lot, but a little bit. So that carbon-14 then gets mixed into our atmosphere. So at any given time, if you analyze the carbon in the air that we breathe, there's a small percentage of it, which is this radioactive version of carbon, even though the half-life is very short. Okay? So if you dig 20 feet down into the ground and you look at what's in the dirt, you're not going to see carbon-14 because any stuff that was down there has been down there a long time and the carbon-14 has long since decayed. But if you're alive, you're breathing carbon-14. And so that means you ingest a certain amount of carbon-14, all living things do, And so the percentage that you see in the atmosphere is basically the percentage that you have in your body. And so this whole idea of you can't avoid radioactive materials, period. You breathe them, they're all around you. It's always a question of degree. So when they talk about radioactive releases in Japan, for example, what is relevant is the release such that it's significantly larger than what you normally just face every day by the fact that you're living in your environment. And not all places are the same, are safe to live. I mean, if you live, for example, in Manhattan, there's a higher background radiation because granite, which Manhattan is built on, has a little bit more radioactive substances than the dirt that we have here. If you go down into your basement, there's a radioactive radon that can come in from the basement, and it's a little more dangerous than it is if you're upstairs, for example. So it can vary a little bit from place to place, but there is normal background radiation. So what happens is, you have some carbon-14 in you, all living things do. When that living thing dies, so you cut the tree and you create, you whittle your nice little wooden object, or you cut the tree and make a fire, or whatever it is that you do, okay? You've killed the tree. At that moment, it stops ingesting carbon-14. The carbon-14 that was in it starts to decay away. So you can now look many, many years later at how much carbon-14 there is in that substance, and you can date how long ago it was killed. And that's the basic idea with carbon-14 dating. So you can look at the carbon-14 to carbon-12 ratio in a substance, and you can calibrate, you can basically figure out how old it is. And that works really well for many thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. You can't use this form of dating for things that are vastly older than that, because there's no carbon-14 left. It all decays away. Half of it disappears every 5,000 years. Yes?
It decays steadily, right?
It decays steadily, yeah. If I had 10 nuclei here, I would not be able to tell you which one will decay. And there'll be some statistical fluctuations, but basically 5,700 years from now, there'd be 5 of them. Yeah.
What happens when there's one left? And then 5,700?
Within 5,700 years, there's a 50-50 probability that it'll decay.
That last.
There's a 50-50 probability it'll still be there.
But it won't split in half, right?
Nope. All right, so this is really great, though, because it means that in terms of archaeology and stuff, there's a really very well-understood pathway to getting dates for dating sites and things like this, dating the paper, dating the Shroud of Turin. I know somebody who did that. There was a physicist here who actually got a little tiny piece of the Shroud of Turin and did radioactive carbon dating of it, using a little nuclear accelerator, counting the number of carbon-14 to carbon-12 atoms he saw. 1,500 is the rough date. Yes?
Sorry, this is going back a bit to before talking about the different types of radiation for the dating. I don't know why I didn't think about this a few weeks ago, like all this stuff with Japan happened, but what are the effects of the reactors in Japan now compared to Hiroshima? What kind of effect is that going to have?
Up until now, the reactors that are currently going haven't released very much stuff. If they do, which I don't know. I'm not incredibly optimistic that we're going to get out of this one without some sort of major release. But then it boils down to exactly what kind of nuclei and stuff they have in there as to exactly what kind of species get formed. I mean, there'll be a lot of similarities because
they're putting all this ocean water into the reactors. I've been doing that's going to stop it. Sorry,
okay.
No,
it's not a tangent. That's actually where we're headed. I was just looking to see how much time I'm going to have to do it. Okay. Yeah. So let me just keep going, and we're gonna get there. We're gonna get there today. Okay. So carbon-14 dating is very cool stuff and can be used to great advantage in some things. Nuclear power is nuclear bombs and nuclear reactors is sort of a direction I wanted to go. And this is sort of the drawing that that makes this all make sense. It's going to take me a minute to explain this. Suppose I have hydrogen here, helium, lithium, you know, all the different types of nuclei sitting here. And I was able to go in to each of these nuclei and grab a proton or a neutron and pull it out. It would take me a certain amount of energy to pull that particle out of the nucleus because they're bound inside the nucleus. So I can call that energy the binding energy. It would be in atoms, if you're moving the electron out, we would call it an ionization energy. But it's sort of the energy with which that particle is being held in. It's how much energy it takes to pull it out. If I were to measure how much energy it takes per nucleon to pull it out for each of these different nuclei types, and I plotted it with this being the energy to pull out the nucleon versus the number of neutrons and protons in the nucleus this way. So hydrogen is right here, gold or something is way up here, lead, iron is about right here. So the large nuclei are over here, the small ones are over here. When I do that, if I make those measurements, I get this curve, okay? For small nuclei, I'm over here. As I go to larger nuclei, it turns out that it takes a little bit more energy to pull out the nucleon. And then when I go to yet larger nuclei, it takes less again, okay? And a way to think about this, the more energy it takes me to pull a nucleon out of that nucleus, the more stable that nucleus happens to be because it's holding those nucleons more and more tightly. Okay? So that means that the nuclei over here are less stable than the nuclei up here. And the nuclei over here are less stable than the nuclei over here. So this then gives us a key to nuclear power in a sense that if I take a very large nucleus and I split it into two, I will create two smaller nuclei where the nucleons are being held more tightly. And there will be an energy difference. Here they're not being held so tightly, and it takes a certain amount of energy to hold everything together. And basically I now split this, and now I get two things where the energy is, they're holding it much more tightly, and there's an energy difference. If I sum these two and compare it to this big one, there's more energy in this big one than there are in the sum of these two. And that energy gets given off. And that's what we call nuclear fission, where you take a large nucleus and you break it apart and it will release energy. That energy comes out in the form of gamma rays or particles like neutrons that come off with a lot of energy. Nuclear fusion, on the other hand, is where I take two small, less stable nuclei and I force them together into a big nucleus, which is more stable, and again, that will release energy. Okay? So if you want to create some sort of device that is self-sustaining in terms of releasing energy, you want to start with either very large nuclei and split them apart, or very small nuclei and add them together. Nuclear fission, nuclear fusion. If you look at the slopes here, if I go from small up to big, there's sort of a steep slope. There's a bigger energy difference typically than there is going from this way. So nuclear fusion is a way of producing sort of powerful energy. But okay, so that's sort of the secret of nuclear power. It's all sort of tied up in this curve. So just keep that in mind. I want to look at a very particular nuclear process, a nuclear fission process. If you take an isotope of uranium known as U-235, it has 92 protons and then a pile of neutrons, so the sum of them is 235. If you hit uranium-235 with a neutron, a fairly low energy neutron, it will split the uranium-235 into two smaller nuclei, one that has 93 protons and neutrons, which is called rubidium, which has 37 protons, and cesium, and it will release two neutrons. Okay? The rubidium and the cesium are naturally radioactive, and they will emit gamma rays. And the neutrons also come off with energy. So if you have fire one neutron and hit the one uranium-235, it will break into these two nuclei, which will emit gamma rays and neutrons. And so basically you're emitting some energy because these come off with some energy and these all come off with some energy. Okay? This process is really important because this is one of the core processes that's used in nuclear power or in nuclear explosions. So the reason that it is so powerful is the following. If I have a pile of uranium-235 sitting here, let's say I have one nucleus of uranium-235 in the middle of it, which decays into, let's say I have one neutron coming in here. It will hit a uranium-235, which will split it into these cesium and rubidium, but it will also emit two neutrons. Each of those will hit a uranium-235 and split into two neutrons. Each of those will give two neutrons. Each of those will give two neutrons. And this is known as a chain reaction. And at each of these splittings, you're releasing energy. So if I have enough U-235 sitting here and I get it started, all of a sudden the whole thing will go. And it will release energy all at once. And if I have enough of it sitting here, that can be explosive and you have a nuclear explosion. If I have less of it, well, so let me just stop there for a second. You okay with this?
So it starts with a neutron hitting U-235?
Yeah. And then those neutrons will hit other U-235s. This whole sample is U-235 nuclei. And so if this sample is big enough, then basically the neutrons can get contained and each of them will break apart more nuclei and you get a very big release of energy, I guess you can call it. So if that happens, we say that the sample is supercritical. And you may say, well, okay. You could have a sample that's smaller the neutron comes in, it hits a U-235, one of the neutrons hits another U-235, but the other neutron now escapes because the sample is sort of small, and neutrons can always go a little ways in a sample before they'll decay, before they'll hit a nucleus. So if for every neutron that's formed, one of them escapes, then you sort of have a one-to-one correspondence. For every split, you get something leaving. So you don't get a runaway reaction. You're not building exponentially every stage. This would be known as a critical sample. And if you wanted to form, for example, a power station, this is a way to do it. Right, because you're not about to explode because you don't have this exponential growth in the number of splits that happen, but you have sort of a steady state. And so if you have this tuned about right, you have this constant release of energy happening, which is exactly what you want if you run a power station. You want that constant release of energy to boil water and run a turbine, basically. So... or you can have, so here we have one split per split, where I talk about splitting the nucleus, okay? You get two neutrons formed for each of those. Here you have two splits per split. You could have something which is called subcritical, where you have a little tiny sample, and basically you have a split, but both neutrons are likely to disappear, so you don't have another split. So now you have less than one split per split. So you okay with that? All right, so if I want to make a power station or I want to make a bomb, then I basically want to have U-235 because it has this characteristic of for every neutron that breaks apart, I get two more neutrons that can cause more of that to happen. So you get this exponential growth, and that's what makes the Big Bang happen. Okay, this bang happened. In the news, we hear a lot about the enrichment of uranium. Right? And this is a big deal with Iran, for example, because they're enriching uranium. What the hell is that about? What that's about is that if you just go out and you dig up some uranium and you look at it, most of it is not this particular isotope. Most of it is a different isotope which has three more neutrons. It's called uranium-238. If you hit uranium-238 with a neutron, you might split it, but you don't get the two neutrons coming out. It does a different sort of splitting because it's a different sort of nucleus. So you can't use uranium-238 to generate power or to make a bomb. So the only way that you can generate power or make a bomb is to separate these two isotopes. Chemically, though, they have the same number of protons, so they have the same number of electrons. Chemically, they're very similar, which means they're very hard to separate. And one way to do it is that uranium-238 has these three more neutrons, which means uranium-238 nuclei or atoms are slightly heavier, not much, but very slightly. So you use high-powered centrifuges, basically spinning it around like a bucket on a string, but really, really fast, and the U-238 will go a little bit more to the outside than the U-235. So if you do enough of that and you keep scraping off the inside, you enrich in uranium-235. And when you get the U-235 enriched up to a certain level, I think it's like 90%-ish if you want a bomb, and less if you want to just generate power, and you have to get it enriched to a certain level before it's actually useful for these things. Technically, that's hard to do, and that's what all this hullabaloo about enriching uranium is in Iran. And Iran says, well, we want to power a station, but people fear bombs. And what the problem is, if you have the technology to generate enriched uranium that can be used to power a station, you effectively can have the technology to enrich it to a level that it can also be used for a bomb. And it's just a question of degree that you enrich it. Okay. Well, so I know class is basically over, but let me spend one more minute because it's going to get to the end of what we're doing. So what happens is that whether you have a nuclear reaction happening or not depends on how much of the stuff you have. If you have a big bunch of stuff, then you'll get this self-sustaining reaction. If you have small bits of stuff, the neutrons will disappear. So one of the things you do in a nuclear reactor or in a nuclear bomb is a nuclear bomb works the following way. I take two bits of substances that are subcritical. That is, the neutrons are more or less disappearing. If I take these and I do that real fast, all of a sudden I go from small to big, and now it's big enough that all the neutrons cause other fissions and the whole thing explodes. So there is one form of a nuclear bomb which is built exactly that way. The one that was dropped on Hiroshima, which is like little boy, starts with a piece of uranium here and a piece of uranium here, and you use explosives to blast this plug of uranium into a hole of that plug of uranium, and you go from two small pits that are subcritical to one that's critical, and boom, you've got the nuclear explosion. In nuclear reactors, you do it much more carefully. You basically have rods of different radioactive substances, and you bring them in closer proximity to one another to get more and more reactions. And this is sort of the way you turn the reactor on and off. But even if you have them far apart, they will naturally have some radioactivity happening, and they'll generate some heat. So the idea is you have these nuclear fuel rods, and these are in close enough proximity that you get a lot of reactions, generates a lot of heat. You can have another substance that's cold here, circulates through it, picks up some of the heat, and then it goes exchange it with some water and it runs a turbine. So the picture of what's actually happening in Japan, they have reactors that look like this, where they don't have that internal loop of stuff. They basically just have water in here and they're generating heat by these things, which then run a turbine. But you'll find two things. This is known as the core of the reactor, and they in principle have it shut off. That is, they either have put stuff in between these things that will absorb the neutrons and keep the rods from interacting with one another, or they separate the rods to where they're all subcritical. So you basically turn off the major power production. But nevertheless, even within each rod, they'll generate a little bit of heat. So after a while, when they've used up most of the uranium or whatever that's in the rod, they'll pull the rod out and they'll store it in a pool, and in this case, up above the reactor. And in the pool, that residual heat boils water, which gets boiled away. So all of this works fine so long as you keep the water there and you sort of can keep it cool. But the minute that you run out of water, for example, in the cooling pool, or you run out of water in here, it's not that you have any danger of an explosion or this thing, but you'll have enough residual heat going on that they'll actually melt. And if they melt, then you get more and more of the radioactive stuff down here, which means you get more and more of the nuclear reactions, which means it gets so hot, basically you can't contain it, and it will cause a fire. And when that happens, you have the radioactive substances going out into the air, and that's when it becomes really dangerous. So that's what's known as a meltdown. And apparently they've already had partial meltdowns, which means they've actually had instances both in the cooling, certainly in the cooling pools, it looks like they've actually lost coverage of some of the water, and it's gotten hot enough to begin to melt the fuel rods a bit. And so what you don't want to happen is to have a massive fire or explosion, which can basically send some of this material up into the atmosphere, which is what happened at Chernobyl and that meltdown. So anyway, it's a very scary situation right now. And in the worst case scenario, if one of them goes, I mean, if one of them gets, if they have enough of a rupture of radiation that people can't get near it, then they can't really control it. They can't keep putting water on it. And then there, you know, basically there are four reactors plus cooling pools of worth of material, and it could be bad. So it's good that the prevailing winds are headed out to the Pacific.
And how long would it take to see the final effects, or when will we know?
I don't know. Right now, they're struggling to keep it under control. If they can just keep, I mean, what's happening is they are slowly cooling down, and so if they can keep water on them over time, they'll get them cool enough, and they'll be okay. But if it starts to melt down and they lose integrity, then you can begin to get piles of stuff, and you have sustaining nuclear reactions going on, and that's when you'll get a meltdown, and it can be bad. So, yeah.
But so I don't understand the cooling pools. Like, were those rods already taken out before?
Yeah, they're taken out. Those are rods where most of the nuclear fuel is used up, but they still have some, and they still are undergoing radioactive decay, so they're still dangerous. They're just not powerful enough to be really good for generating power. So they pull those rods out, and they put them in what they call cooling pools, and the cooling is both basically allowing short-lived, very short half-life stuff to decay away in the pool, but it also generates some heat, and so they put in a big pile of water because it protects people who are outside the pool from the water, from the stuff emitted. It gets absorbed in the water. The other thing is it literally absorbs the heat so the material doesn't melt itself. But what happens is if you don't circulate the water through here, it generates enough heat, it'll actually boil the water away. And if you boil it away and it uncovers it, then it can start to melt down or cause a fire, and then you've got a real problem. So then you have a meltdown. So I'm way past time, sorry. So. They don't have oil.
Oh.
They don't have oil. They don't have coal.
Okay. So, like, why don't they have?
And China is talking about. I mean, it's a great source. Nuclear power is wonderful in a lot of ways because it doesn't produce greenhouse gases.
Yeah.
And so. I don't know. That is not so obvious, because if you calculate cancer rates from the emission of coal emissions, for example, it's not trivial. You have a lot of ill health effects that come from the emission of oil based stuff and coal based stuff. And even if you were to do an honest comparison of number of effective deaths caused by this, even with an occasional meltdown, versus what we get with the oil and the coal or whatever, which is more subtle,
yeah.
Right? It isn't obvious that nuclear doesn't win. It's just nuclear is definitely scary.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah, my grandpa actually, like, when they were doing all, like, the testing and
I forgot to.
Stuff, he was living down there, not too far, like one of the areas where they're doing, like, all the nuclear testing, you know?
Yeah, that.
And it's interesting because he actually, I mean, he had other health issues, but he did have leukemia, and he did have a blood transfusion, but, like, we always, like, kind of wonder.
Well, you never know.
Maybe, like, when he was little living in Arizona, you know, like,
you never know. I mean, it's all a game of statistics, too, right? I mean, there are radioactive substances from Chernobyl around you and me, right? But how much cancer can you attribute to that? And, I mean, statistically, people can do the calculations. They can tell you that, you know,